Welcome to the Stinging Fly podcast. My name is Nicole Flattery. The Stinging Fly has been publishing new writers and new writing for the past 25 years. We take a particular interest in promoting the short story, and for this podcast, we ask a writer to root around our archive and pick out a story to read and discuss with me here. On this month's episode, I'm joined by writer Claire Louise Bennett, who has chosen to read from Lucy Sweeney Byrne's story, To Cure a Body. To Cure a Body was published in issue 35, volume 2 of The Stinging Fly, the Fear and Fantasy issue, guest edited by Mia Gallagher. Hi, Claire Louise.
Hello, Nicole.
And happy Valentine's Day.
Happy Valentine's Day, sweetheart.
Would you like to read from the story for us?
Yeah, it's a very...
It's a very good story.
I'm not sure it's a very Valentine story, but it's a very good story. This story is called To Cure a Body, and it's by Lucy Sweeney Byrne. For her ache, she discovered a cure. It was simple and comparatively pain-free. It worked on a basic principle that a dull pain is negated by an acute one. To provide an explanation, a person wouldn't mourn athlete's foot when faced with a sudden, vicious stab wound to the throat. That's the beauty of piercing agony, the pure white sheen that overwhelms the clutter and mud of other less immediate ills. Her ache was felt chiefly in the lower stomach. Some refer to it as heartache, but for her this was anatomically inaccurate, even absurd. For her, it was located specifically in the pit of her womb. She had not even known before that she could feel her womb lurking there inside. The ache wrapped itself around her fallopian tubes and enveloped her ovaries, making them blue-black inky feeling. Her womb's fleshy inner walls were turned to ash from the grief of it. To give a sense of the time before the cure, she had developed an odour that she was largely unaware of. It was not dissimilar to that found at the entrance to underground train stations at night in summer, heat and engine oil and sweat and animal piss and sex rising with a hint of rose eau de toilette. Before the cure, her skin had faded pink and grey, vague, hard-to-see colours, blanching meek in between the real ones. She had trouble being. Clawing, gnawing, gnashing, these had been the words for her then. Before discovering her cure, she had lain awake at night, unable to sleep, because of the dry heat curling in the corners of her. She hadn't slept for months, years even. She'd lain clasping at air and soiled sheets, bunched in fists across the surface of the bed. Her insides had hissed and screeched at her like damp winter logs burning, until she'd felt that she'd sooner go deaf than suffer the sheer, endless wall of it. Of course, though, had anyone been there listening, under the bed or lurking outside the bedroom door, they wouldn't have heard a sound. At this time, it would have been a relief for her to end. She couldn't pretend she hadn't dreamt of it, hadn't savoured the taste. She'd imagined it to be like diving headfirst into cool waters. Those electric blueberry jelly waters, photographed in catalogues, flicked through idly while waiting around indoors for nothing in particular on muggy midweek afternoons. She'd imagined ending then to be like a floating outward, in the belly of that water, into nothing, in contact with nothing, forgetting the feeling of her body wrapped around her. But now for a good part. She always liked to cook, and to eat, even more than was necessary. She would have listed insatiability as one of her many defining faults. As a result, in her lingering confinement, she grew fat, a protective thickening of the flesh. Dulling layers swelled across her bones and thoughts. Food fooled her, momentarily, into believing that she was becoming full, filled, similar to the ephemeral satisfaction of another tongue in the mouth seeking strange, warm spit, or semen burrowing in, warming the tummy. Eating afforded her a vague respite. if not yet a cure. Upon the eve of her discovery, had anyone decided on a whim to check in on her, they'd have found her chopping onions by the kitchen sink. The sink faced a window covered in a thin film of grime. The light outside signified day ending. She was making a tomato sauce with Italian sausage and rich egg pasta, and was going to eat it all up with warmed blood-red wine. Soft, liquid food to, for a second maybe, quench the dry ash of her womb. She diced her onions finely, and their odour combined with hers, creating a savoury haze. The slight movements in the atmosphere around her eddied cinders and fumes. The oil was warming in the pan. The radio played some song about living, and she listened vacantly through the din of herself. It was in this absent ocean floor state, chopping steadily, that she managed to bring the knife swiftly and expertly down upon the very base of the index finger on her left hand, the one holding the back of the onion in place, severing it from the rest of her body. This was a surprise. Hot ash air escaped her mouth in a sharp rush, only to be sucked in again quickly between clenched jaw teeth. She dropped the knife on the countertop. The sudden clatter was unpleasant. Blood spurted from the twitching finger and her brand spanking new fingerless stump. The blood felt exposed. It had not expected to be revealed to the world at this moment. It had been coursing happily through hidden tunnels and passageways, murmuring and giggling. Now it came in limp, rhythmic waves, an unenthused ejaculate, shamed, the blushing crimson shocking in its vibrancy against the dusky evening light. The radio played on another song, something about love or death. The oil began to emit a faint blue smoke, impending fire. Too hot, careful. She turned off the gas with her remaining five-fingered hand. She paused. The room hung suspended. Blood trickled down her wrist over her elbow, soaking into the cuff of her dress. She knew it must be wet and warm, but she felt nothing. For as long as her memory was willing to unfurl, she'd known her ache. Now, without warning, there was only numbness, that long-sought void. The realization flitted behind her eyes, but she didn't blink. Her lip didn't even twitch. She was careful not to openly acknowledge, to betray. Not even on the inside of her mind. Someone would see. The ache would see. She knew she needed to conceal the thought from herself, to keep in check this quickening of her heart. To steady now. She breathed through her nose, slowly, deliberately. She waited for the room to settle. A little aside, a recollection of the world going on around her, at this exact moment as she stood there suspended, studying the remaining parts of the hand raised before her face, a cat-shaped blur leaped up onto the windowsill outside and peered in with yellow orb eyes. It had been attracted from the hedgerow's depths, perhaps by curiosity or the scent of blood. Or perhaps a conscientious awareness of the need, at this point, for a witness. It mewed, feigned a yawn, sleek, pink-armoured mouth circling wide, and watched. Without a word, without even a flicker across her long pink-grey face, she quickly, excitedly, as though her thoughts were busy elsewhere on tomorrow's chores maybe, or the tomorrow's after, bandaged up her loss. She used iodine and white porous cloth from the dusty first aid kit, which sat atop the pine dresser that stood against the beading wall to the right of the sink. Note that the shelves of this dresser held no framed photographs, although there was plenty of space for them. She took up the knife. She didn't wipe off what had recently been her blood before resuming her dicing. The severed finger, now turning a fashionable off-white, severed digit pallor, lay untouched to the left of her onion shards. The browning blood had trickled in a small pool across the grooves of the board, dyeing the layers of onion skin a fleshy pink. Its metallic odour mixed well with the onion's warm, wholesome one. She didn't mention to herself what she was doing, the part of her mind in control of doing actions and the part of her mind in charge of taking note of those doings were not in contact with one another just then. She had cut the line. It was easier that way. At this moment, she simply was. A pleasant numb of nothing. She didn't rush. She reignited the gas flame and tipped onion shards into sizzling virgin oil. They sloshed and hissed in the pan as she stirred. Their ruddy flavour rose to her nostrils. The cat-shaped blur watched. It was black and well-fed, with a red collar and a small silver name tag, but without a bell for warning birds. The blur sniffed, reaching nose forward before recoiling, compressing its body back in feigned indifference. It turned its head to the left and squinted close its eyes. She added crushed garlic and chopped tomatoes and a little squeeze of lemon, black pepper, salt and a few basil leaves. She added 1 teaspoon of granulated sugar. And still, there was nothing. The radio, yet another song, something about people and loneliness, continued to evince no reaction from her, although the sounds proved useful for distraction. But she did realise, deep down somewhere in the quiet places, behind the radio, the hum and sizzle of the ingredients coalescing into soft red in the pot, and her busily clanking mind, that she could hear it clearly. The absence. There was no screech, no hiss, no groan, no grinding flesh and bone. Anyone who entered her at that moment would have found inside only an echoing silence. The sauce bubbled and reduced and thickened. With surprisingly little difficulty, considering her recent disfigurement, she opened the wine bottle that had been warming by the furnace and drank deeply from the glass. The tannins slicked the inside of her mouth and throat with blackberries and spice, a thin, blood-like film. Her pasta water was simmering and her usual place at the table was set. She lit a long, thin white candle with a match, flicking the flame against the box with a sharp twitch of her wrist. Then the finishing touch. She took out the sweet Italian sausage from the fridge and smacked the pack onto the bloody chopping board. Her finger lay dead and unburied, slightly to the left. She had not actively remembered, nor for one moment forgotten it. She took her sausages and cut them lengthways down the middle. She then cut them crossways several times to create small chunks. She threw the pieces into the bubbling sauce. Next, as though it were just a nothing, not pausing at all in the flow of her motions, she took the finger, cool like an old man's cheek, and expertly slit it down the middle, from the fingertip to the amputated end. She put down her knife and neatly removed the chip nail from its bed, before gently tugging the long, thin bone, the small, rounded knuckles, delicate and white, out from the centre. It came away easier than she'd expected. When she had divided it into two halves, running the silver tip of the blade along with careful precision, it was an elegant finger, she could appreciate that now. She chopped the flesh up crossways into neat little chunks and, with a swish of the knife, scraped them down off the board and into the pot. Now, how to convey the following? It was the greatest meal of her entire life. It was intoxicating. When her plate was finished, she piled it up again and again until every last scrap was devoured, and she licked it sparkling clean. Halfway through, insatiable, she opened another red with a pop, arm flung back and drank straight from the bottle, whacking it down on the table between gulps and smacking her lips together contentedly. She ate with such ferocious intent that she lost her breath. Sauce spilled down her chin and onto her chest, embedding itself in caking little dollops on her dress and trickling down her décolletage into the rifts between her breasts. She had forgotten a person could feel like this. Her eyes dilated and her body grew supple and soft and willing. Her meat, cooked to perfection, was melting in the mouth. With each bite, she felt stronger. She wanted all of it, thick and red, and she swallowed it all deep down into her belly. It flooded through her trunk and limbs, heating her from the inside out so that steam rose off her skin, making it glow wet burgundy, like the skins of fat men in saunas. Afterwards, she took the pot into her open lap, legs spread, and ran her remaining fingers around the inside, noisily sucking the last of the sauce off the tips. Her palms and crotch and behind her knees grew sodden. The combined odour emanating from her and her food became overwhelming. The air was dense with the heat and stench of it. She felt, by the end, like she wanted to tip over the table and set the house on fire and fly screaming naked down the street, eyes ablaze. Sitting there intoxicated and full at the kitchen table, belly bulging forward, she laughed in the face of her ache. It was really gone, she thought. She laughed and laughed again, her head back, a guttural rupture booming from the depths of her.
Thank you. That was beautifully read. So, Claire Louise, why this story?
Ooh, it's quite grisly, isn't it?
It's very grisly.
It's making me feel a little sick though. I felt a little bit queasy reading the but it's just so precisely described as well.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, where she talks about, I mean, you know the finger is going to get it because of the description of the sausages, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
When she starts talking about the sausages on the chopping board, well, you think, well, all right,
mm.
you know the finger's there and it's not unlike a sausage in a way. So,
yeah, that's a good question.
You know what I mean? It totally kind of preempts that, really. So, and I love how she doesn't really shy away from the detail of the description of removing the nail from its bed. I mean, that's just...
Mm-hmm.
really unpleasant. I like it because a lot of short stories tend to be in the very sort of realist sort of mode.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And they're often kind of situations, they home in on situations between people.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really enjoy those sorts of stories
mm-hmm.
very much. I don't know why. I just find them... I don't know. Sometimes it can be a bit formulaic even.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think sometimes there's such a sort of an awareness of the craft of the mm-hmm. short story
yeah, yeah, yeah.
and what a perfect short story is
mm.
and what they can kind of do and the focus that they should bring to bear.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I think people are very, very conscious of that sometimes. Mm. And when I'm reading them, I find that sort of... that awareness and the attention to that
yeah.
sort of almost sort of quite cloying in a way. I just feel it's sort of a bit airless or something.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I tend to kind of orientate more towards short stories that are quite macabre actually.
Mm-hmm.
Like obviously Poe would be one and Shirley Jackson would be another one. That sort of explore kind of, or Mary Gateskill, who isn't necessarily macabre, but there's a sense of going somewhere sort of a bit weird.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
You know?
Going somewhere weird is always good.
Going somewhere, and I think the short story can do that
because
it's not asking you to stay with it for long.
Yeah.
You know? I might find it tough going to stick with a book that was really grisly, like for hundreds of pages.
Yeah, I don't think I could read that for hundreds of pages.
For hundreds of pages.
No.
No. So, I also kind of like it because... You know, rather than it being a situation between people, it's a situation with one person.
Yeah,
and I kind of like that, and it doesn't necessarily have to sort of you know go anywhere, but it's just really exploring this this environment and this condition, and there's nobody else sort of witnessing, which becomes also part of one of the story's themes in a way as well.
Mm.
I mean, there are several lines that. Say, had anyone been there, or had anyone passed by, or had anyone entered her, or so there's always this kind of quite strange, almost sort of like gothic reference to this absent other, which I also find very effective. But then, so I think it was probably those qualities sort of combined that drew me to it, and I suppose the attention put on. The body and how it feels and blood and emptiness and hunger and consuming and appetite and all those things that are sometimes things that we're kind of made to feel slightly sort of ashamed of. I mean, that's great, that last piece there, that last paragraph where she's kind of sat, you know, and it says legs spread, you know, it's almost a very manly kind of position that she takes. Then with the pot between her legs, you know, and she's kind of clearing it out with her fingertips. And I have to say, actually, it did sort of remind me a little bit. Very recently, I just read an extract from Justine by the Marquis de Sade.
It
was only an act, because again, like that, that's a novel, but I'm really not sure I'd be able to take the whole thing. I'm very intrigued by it. It sounds. I mean, I kind of enjoy reading bits of the Marquis de Sade, but I don't think I'd manage maybe to stick with a whole book. But there was, in the passage I read, there is a description of, I guess he's a count. It's usually a count, isn't it, in these kinds of stories. And he has a huge, huge appetite. Mm. And before he goes in to visit the countess, who he has, you know, tied up, she's imprisoned, and he does various quite cruel things to her. Before he does that, he has these huge meals, and they're described in detail. And he'll drink, you know, 10 bottles of wine, and he'll be eating guinea fowl and and jellied meats and all kinds of things. And it's all very, very detailed. And I was thinking of it when I read her description about this eating, this stuffing herself and this feeling of being full. And I couldn't help but kind of link it to that. And then by contrast, so he's really stuffing himself, right? He's drinking all this wine and all these game pies and God knows what else. And then he goes in and there's a kind of a maid that assists him with sort of handling his wife, because she has to sort of be positioned in certain ways, and then she's tied up. And the big thing that he does with her is he cuts her. Mm. So again, we've got this sort of cutting action, but he's inflicting these wounds, and she bleeds. The countess, she just kind of bleeds until she just becomes very, very weak, and she's laid out again, and she has to sort of recover. And she, you know, it takes her 2 or 3 days, and she's just becoming frailer and frailer. But he inflicts, like, it's almost like this slow death of a, you know, by 1,000 cuts kind of thing. So this is kind of, in this story, you know, she's taking control of both elements of that. You know, she's doing the eating, she's doing the cutting, she's doing the, you know. So it's an interesting kind of flip.
Yeah. It's a way. Something you said there about the kind of perfection of the short story. I really feel that sometimes when I go to write a short story, I feel, you know, tense in a way.
Right, tense,
Where I'm like, this can't be wrong. I have to get it right every single...
Because it's like it already exists.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
And you've got to kind of...
And there is all these...
Show that you know that it already exists.
Exactly. And there's a tradition and...
Exactly.
Yeah. And every sentence has to be like, boom, 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 in a way that I don't feel when I approach like a longer piece. And it can lead to writing, I think, that's sometimes a little tense and a little, like you said, a little airless, not playful, very direct. And I think this story is actually very... playful. It's like the language is alive, very alive, you know. When you started writing, because I something I noticed in that story is it really follows a person's mind, which is what you do in Pond and Checkout 19. You're very close to the how the person is thinking. When you started writing, did you think of you were writing short stories, or how did you approach it? Did they feel like stories to you, or did they feel like they were going to be longer pieces?
Well, for a long time, they were always very, very short, even shorter than, you know, short stories.
Yeah.
And I was writing for a really long time before I started to think about looking to get published, you know. I don't know, could have been 20 years even, really. It was a long time. So in a way, of course I think about this quite a lot, and my take on it changes quite often. But I suppose what occurred to me recently, you know, I kind of think of these things and then I think, God, it sounds a bit melodramatic in a way. So I don't know, I take it with a pinch of salt, to be honest, what I say. But an idea I had then is that kind of growing up and stuff, I think there was a point when I just started to internalize a lot of things I was sort of thinking and feeling. And, I guess quite a few people kind of experienced that sudden sort of turn yeah. inwards, you know. And that was partly to do with, I found it very hard to make myself understood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was just difficult for me to sort of maybe find the words or to find the right person who would, you know, listen and understand the things I was saying, because they might have been a little bit far out. I don't know, really, you know. But there was a kind of a difficulty there. And that did go on for quite a long time, actually. Yeah. I just said, you know, would kind of say things or feel things that were maybe just a little kind of bit, I don't know. Not, I don't know whether they were unusual, but maybe there were things that people just didn't want to particularly dwell on that much or something. Mm. And so because a lot of that then became sort of internalized, in a way, I feel like a sort of a language developed very much in me that didn't see the light of day for a long time.
Mm.
So if you think about it, it's sort of developed in the dark, like a sort of a subterranean type thing.
Mm.
And it wasn't really, something that was supposed to be kind of used maybe day to day in order to communicate in the normal kind of run of things. So it's very much this sort of weird sort of language in very inside, very submerged, very kind of, and it, you know, like anything that grows in the dark, it was probably a bit warped and a bit peculiar and maybe, you know, took on its own sort of strange kind of qualities, maybe. So then at some point, I kind of, I suppose, realised that I needed to almost bring it into the light of day. And then that process was really, took me quite a long time to do. And I enjoyed, I mean, I was writing for a long time in that sort of subterranean mode, if you like. And I still have pieces from that period of time, actually. And they are actually quite nonsensical, you know. Because I wasn't really concerned with making sort of sense in the way that we... It's like, you know, we went to the Super Meredith Monk concert last night. And I was just so interested to hear her, you know, because she's singing, but she's not singing words.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's these sounds, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And it almost did remind me of you know, earlier phases of writing that I went through.
Mm.
And okay, I was using words, but I wasn't using them to form sort of sentences in the way that we kind of would normally understand a sentence, you know?
Yeah.
And they weren't functioning in that way particularly either. They were much more evocative in a way. They almost had that shamanic quality that we kind of witnessed last night, you know, that they are sort of between the threshold of sort of one place and another.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're kind of wanting to sort of maybe commune with something sort of, I don't know, elsewhere or something. So there was all that going on for quite a long time, you know. And then, you know, then there's practical things, I suppose, where I realised that I did need to have some sort of vocation, you know, going forward in life. I needed to be able to sort of do something with myself. And that just seemed to be the thing that I was prepared to dedicate myself to and could apply myself to. Other things I'd kind of get a bit fed up with, you know. Well, they disappoint me because they wouldn't be as exciting or as glamorous. Like, I did have an idea about being a solicitor, but I mean, that was very dull. I did a work experience for a couple of weeks and it was just really dull. And I had these glamorous ideas about being in court and God knows what.
Yeah, but it wasn't like glamorous that. Ideas. Yeah. And then, you know,
So work experience was great in that regard because it soon put pay to any of those notions. So I didn't waste any time doing law or any, and to be, you know, kind of rudely awakened at the end of it all. It was nipped in the bud early on. So it was very, it was a slow process and I was making these kind of small things to begin with. And I remember sort of gradually showing them to people and stuff like that. And I got the very useful advice at one stage actually from a kind of an academic. And he said, well, this is very good. It was a short piece, maybe 900 words. This is very good, he says. But, you know, a short story should be 2,000 words. You know, it was like... Okay.
Yeah. It's hard in the beginning,
I think. Strange. Yeah. I mean, I didn't take any notice of that. I knew it was kind of just kind of a spurious thing to sort of come out with, really. Yeah. And I mean, was it around that time? No, it was maybe a few years after that, actually. I was very fortunate to discover the work of Lydia Davis.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
Who I still think is
amazing.
Really, really fantastic. Mm. What she does with shorter prose, some very short, some, you know, more conventional kind of lengths. And they're so rangy in what they're looking at and how they're doing that. And, you know, so that was, so it was just, and I'm still, you know, I'm sure you feel the same way about what you do. It's always trying to find form, given shape to things, you know. And I think it was maybe a couple of things, you know, in tandem, probably. It took me quite a long time to give myself shape.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
As just a person in the world. It's like, well, how, you know, how do I give myself form and the rest of it? So it's, yeah, the two things are kind of very much sort of related, you know. And I think as well, you know, it sort of would reflect how you feel about just life and reality and so on. And I mean, maybe some people do feel that things happen for a reason and maybe one thing leads to another. And if you do that, then that will kind of surely occur. And I don't really feel that way. Yeah. I do feel things are fundamentally quite chaotic.
Yeah.
I think quite arbitrary, you know?
Yeah. And I think the short story is a good sometimes reflection of that. Like, it doesn't have to follow the plot of a novel. It can just be a moment or in this case, like a feeling or a feeling that comes underneath a moment. So when you were working on Pond, did you know you were working on putting together a book, or were you, did you feel it was a book, or were you kind of working on the pieces separately? And
so initially when I was working on it to begin with, I thought it was actually going to be something for theatre.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah. I mean, I just sort of pulled out of doing the PhD in post-dramatic theatre.
Yeah.
So I had been thinking very much about theatre making.
Mm-hmm.
And that was still very much part of how I guess, thought about prose and so on.
Yeah.
And then I don't know at what point I kind of decided that it didn't really maybe need dramatizing.
Mm.
You know, I there was a point when I thought, would I think it maybe comes alive enough in the mind of the reader?
Mm.
But actually what that did give me, that period of time when I was thinking about it in terms of theatre, was I was thinking very much about notions such as presence.
Yeah.
And that was something that interested me much more than, say, character.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know yourself from writing that there's a lot of emphasis put upon creating convincing characters. Yeah. And there's different techniques that kind of help that along. And it's the same in theatre. Mm. There's different rehearsal techniques. I suppose the most famous one is Chekhov's acting method and so on. There's all these different ways that we have of... It's kind of weird.
Yeah.
Or, you know, it's this kind of weird Frankenstein sort of approach of how do we create this other human being, you know?
Yeah.
And there's all these different ways of doing it. And it's kind of funny. And I, you know, I was aware of those in the theatre. And I used to hate it as when I was acting. I used to hate a lot of those sorts of methods. I used to find them so phony and peculiar, you know. And it's the same with writing. And I thought, well, I'm not going to just start writing kind of like all these sort of details so that people start, you know, visualising and getting, you know, it just seems a bit weird to me. But what I really wanted to do was create a presence for a reader to really feel that somebody was there, even if they didn't know what they looked like.
Yeah.
And didn't know what age they were and what they really did and all those details that we normally rely upon or think are absolutely crucial.
Yeah.
You know, what if you don't have those things? You know, what? I mean, it's something that Beckett does in his work, right?
Yes.
Strips away all of that. And the reason that he did that is very similar to the reason why I do that, it's because that's just the surface of life.
Yeah.
And I'm not that interested in, you know, I want to get in somewhere a bit deeper.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like he doesn't really go in. Or if he does go in, it's always contradicted in some way, or it's negated in the next line. So he might establish something about a character and you think you've got something to hold on to, and then it's sort of gone again, you know. I really enjoy that. I think it's quite interesting. So then, you know, what you just have then, I suppose, is just like this sense of something there, existence. And then you're having to think, well, what is that then?
Mm.
What is it essentially that's just there if you take everything away?
So
all those things, I suppose, if that's the sort of mode that you're working in and thinking and so on, then that affects your relationship to form and to language and the usual kind of conventional apparatus, I suppose, like character and plot and so on, because it's just very difficult to get on board with those kinds of things, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So. Yeah. And when you were working on Checkout 19, were you looking at work you had written before? Like, I know you've spoken to me a little bit about this, like kind of looking through past notebooks and things like that. Is that how it kind of came together? I love that book, by the way.
Thank
you. Such a great book about reading and working in a supermarket. I also worked in a supermarket, apparently, so two Checkout girls.
What was your uniform like?
Oh, it was a Tesco uniform, so it was like a blue check shirt and not particularly flattering, and little name tag.
Yes.
And
did you wear trousers or a skirt?
Trousers.
Oh, you had okay. Yeah. Okay. I envy you. We had a skirt. I will say this used to really baffle me.
Yeah.
I had a skirt, very, you know, unattractive, horrible material.
Yeah.
Horrible, unflattering length. And I'd be sitting at the checkout all day.
Yeah.
And somehow, even though I was sitting at the checkout pretty much all day, I would start off with the zip, you know, at the back where it should be. And by the end of my shift, it would have moved all the way around to the front. And I never understood how that happened. It was just weird. So the whole skirt is just swivel. I guess I was swiveling maybe on the chair, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Scanning stuff and then maybe to the till, or I don't know what it was that was going on, but it always just, yeah, did 180.
Did you like it? How did you feel about that
job? What, the skirt?
No, the job.
The job. No, I didn't like it. I used to cry on the till.
Oh,
I used to make myself cry. So that, then they'd buzz me through. My supervisor would buzz me through. And she'd go, do you want to put your sign up and go for a fang? And I'd be like, yes, please. But, that's quite grisly. I mean, I'm sure I've told you this story. I don't know whether I should mention it, actually, because it is a bit grim. But Fred West worked at that supermarket.
God.
So that was just to take us back into the...
You need to write about that,
the world
I think.
Of the grim. And I'm no, because I thought about it, because I did actually ask him for a cigarette one day, and he did give me a cigarette one day.
Oh, God. And this is the grisliest podcast yet.
It is quite, yeah. And he did, he also asked me if I'd like a lift home.
Oh.
I know. And I said, no, you're all right. And I didn't know, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of funny, because people say to me, oh, did you know? You know, looking at him. And I know, I didn't know. How did you know?
How could you possibly know?
How did I know that he had like all these women buried in his back garden after torturing them in his chamber in the cellar of his house? No, I didn't know that, actually.
Oh,
I thought he was a bit of a grim odd, but that was about it. Do you know what I mean?
A strange person, but
well, just a bit grim. You know, when you're that age, and all blokes over about, I don't know, 35 probably, you just think, a bit of a grim odd. That was about all. No, I didn't think he was doing
what he was doing. But were you scanning, like you're just scanning things all day? Because that's what I did.
I was in the bakery for a while as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was putting jam into donuts.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
that
it's really
sounds
interesting.
A bit more fun.
It is interesting, actually, because you have this little device, like you inject them, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
That's why they've got like that little funny bumhole kind of thing that they have, because that's where the thing goes in and comes out again.
That's something I never think about. Like when you eat a donut, and you're like, I never think about where the jam comes from.
Yeah, you squeeze it in.
Yeah, I know. But when I worked in the till, I never had a job before since that I thought less. I never thought. So you could go for like 8 hours, full shift, and you would like leave and you almost wouldn't remember you had been there. It's sort of fascinating the way it like wipes your mind clean.
That's true.
Yeah. In some ways it'd be brilliant for writing, but you write about it so beautifully in that book. And you also have if you could talk about it a little bit, there is a story in Checkout 19 about, what's the name of the guy? It's a longish piece in the book. And he has a library.
Oh, Tarquin Superbus.
Superbus. How did that come about?
So that was based on... So actually, there's a bit of cannibalizing that goes on in my writing. Yeah. And maybe that's what also attracted me a little bit to the story I read just now, this act of sort of self-cannibalizing. I do go back and look at notebooks and stuff, and some of them do go back quite a long time now. And like I said, some of them haven't actually seen the light of day. There's a lot, there's an awful lot there that hasn't been published and probably doesn't really need to be published either, you know, but it is a kind of, I don't know. So, but there, I mean, there were certain things, and then there's certain things then that I've written about again and again. That's the other thing too, right? So sometimes they're actual specific episodes that have happened that are for whatever reason. Well, because you do, don't you? Because you look back on it again and you might see it slightly differently or whatever it might be. That's always sort of happening, isn't it? And then there are certain, maybe just very quite small specific motifs that I'm sort of unconsciously repeating. And that can be very interesting when you see those showing up over a number of years.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what's so fascinating about going to see an artist's retrospective.
Yeah.
Because there it's sort of visually apparent, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like if you see the Louise Bourgeois or something retrospective, or you can really see the things that just obsessed her really throughout her life. So that's interesting material to have. And I have it all kind of by hand. It's not like I have it on a computer. I write by hand. I think if it was in the computer, I just wouldn't have a sense of it at all, actually. Because I quite often, I don't know whether you have this, but I quite often write something and then I'll, even within a matter of a few weeks, I'll have completely forgotten about it.
Yeah.
And if I find it again on the computer, say if I've done it on, or in a notebook, I'll read through it. And it's almost like it's completely new to me.
Yeah.
I've got a very bad memory.
I have a terrible memory. It's getting worse as well, but it's good for stuff like this that you've like.
It is quite useful in a way because it means you do have some sort of critical distance from it, because you're a bit like, I don't really remember writing this, bloody hell. And then you kind of realize that, oh, actually, yeah, I did that just about a month or so ago. And that's kind of strange. There's kind of, I suppose, different, not versions, but I suppose iterations maybe, and in Checkout 19, they are all kind of given a place, because I wondered about that with certain things. I thought, well, I just sort of fuse them into sort of, you know, one version, if you like, one definitive version. Yeah. And I thought, well, no, there isn't one definitive version, actually. Yeah. And all these are quite valid, you know, whether it's the episode I was writing about at college or just different things. I included the different layers, I suppose. See, I don't find that a particularly fragmented text, but I do think it's very layered. And I am interested in that idea of layering.
Yeah.
So that certain material might be repeated, but just never in the same kind of way, or not exactly the same. Because it sort of does indicate how memory works and how what happens when time passes. And just not just memory, but how your own perspective anyway changes because of, you know, just getting older and you just see things. It's almost like you're pulling away a bit, isn't it?
Yeah.
And getting more and more distance, and you're seeing a kind of a fuller picture all the time. Whereas when you're younger, it's just, it really is all about you, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that's understandable in a way because you are, you know, still sort of forming and stuff like that. And you're so, I suppose, sensitive, and everything sort of hits you, you know, so strongly and has such impact on you, and you really can only just sort of see it in those terms. But
yeah,
of course, as you get older, you empathize hopefully with other people, and you start to see things from where they are, and maybe don't take things so personally as a result.
Yeah,
because you think, well, they didn't really do that maybe to hurt me, even though they might have hurt me. There were maybe other things kind of going on, so one of those things. And so your understanding of situations in life is always kind of shifting, I think. So there is no real definitive.
But through kind of having this writing and things, you can go back and see that perspective of your younger self. Do you find that useful? And do you feel like a distance from that person?
It's not necessarily, because I'm just conscious of the fact that I'm almost saying that you know, you're moving towards a place of, you know, better understanding mm. or, you know, wisdom. And I certainly wouldn't claim that mm. either. You know, I certainly wouldn't say I'm any wiser. I mean, and then there are certain things, that just those qualities that I've just mentioned, I suppose, that in a way I do miss, mm. you know, just that level of acute sensitivity and yeah. Yeah. and really picking up on things and having that mm. kind of sensory sort of acuteness. And I think Ian Forster had a lovely word for mm. it, this kind of profound vivacity mm. he talked about, where you're just everything, you're responding to everything.
Yeah.
You know, you're conscious of everything all the time.
Mm.
Of course you can't go on like that, living your whole life like that. But that brings with it its own sort of wisdom, if you like.
Yeah.
And you know, it does recede a bit.
Mm.
And you know, it sort of, maybe there are moments of it.
Mm.
But it's not as constant as it is when you're younger, you know.
Yeah.
And certainly when I read passages that I wrote quite a long time ago, mm. I'm really struck, you know. And how bodily it is too, mm. which is another mm. another trait of this book, story that I enjoyed. Just, yeah, how very, very bodily
mm.
it is, and just how you feel things, and how the relationship, I suppose, between your body and your emotions and your thoughts are all so intertwined,
mm.
you know, they really are. And you, it's very difficult to know which one is affecting what and which has the more power, you know.
Yeah.
Am I feeling like this because my body's a bit kind of off? Or is mm. my body off because I'm feeling like this? Or am I thinking this because my blood sugar or my period? Mm. Or, you know, it's just very hard to know which way it goes. And mm. it's just always going round and round,
mm.
you know.
Mm.
And it's very hard to sort of kind of get on top of that sometimes.
Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah, and that never goes away, really.
It never goes away. Have you read the, like a great example of the kind of diary, and then the novel is the Annie Ernaux, the Getting Lost is the diaries, and is, I think A Simple Passion is the novel. And it's amazing to read the two together, isn't it?
Yeah, it is actually.
So when you, like the diary is incredible.
Mm.
I think I feel more for the diaries than the novel.
I do. That's interesting, actually, mm. because I remember about 10 years ago, I wrote a piece for Gorse about Elizabeth Smart's diaries. Elizabeth Smart was a Canadian mm. poet, and her very famous novella is Down by Grand Central Station. I sat down and wept. And it's a very well-known mm. novella, and it describes this love affair she had with another poet, George Barker, mm-hmm. who was married. And she took a bit of a shine to him after reading his book, mm. one of his books of poems, in a bookshop in Charing Cross Road. She read them and she was like, kind of, this is the man for me. Mm. And I was a bit curious about that, because I was like, well, I know that sounds like a kind of good tagline, but what does that actually really mean? How do you do that? Like, how do you actually, why has she done that? Why has she fallen in love with a man based on his poems? And, you know, what was she looking for? And so I was kind of unpacking that. And part of doing that involved me getting her diaries.
Mm-hmm.
And the diaries are extraordinary.
Mm.
The first volume, I think, begin when she's 19 years old. I'm just trying to place it when she was maybe... She was 19 in 1933. So I don't know, my maths are kind of crummy. But so anyway, whatever age, that means she was... 11, 10, mm. 9, no, not even. I don't know when she was born. But anyway, she's 19 in 1933.
These two
right?
women were cashiers.
And she's, I know, yeah. And she's going on this world tour with her chaperone, Mrs. Watt. And they go everywhere. They go like all over the world. They go to Fiji, Palestine, Ceylon. It's incredible. And it's a beautiful, the diary is beautiful. And it is that, it's so sensuous. And everything, like she's just taking everything in. And she's able to really describe the sensation of things and the colour and the texture and the atmosphere. And then of course, there's those times when she's just really flat and she's really like, oh, what am I going to do? And, you know, I don't feel... And she's quite hard on herself then for not applying herself and having discipline and all those things.
Yeah.
You know, you go back and forth because you kind of realise, well, I you know, I need to give myself shape. I need to be in the world. I need to belong to the world. I need to get on in it and do stuff. But at the same time, she says, you know, I still want to have this sensation of being at one with everything and being open to everything and being in the flow of it all, you know. So it kind of goes back and forth between those kind of two forces, I suppose. And then at a certain point, it talks about then her feelings about what a relationship might be and desire. And what she seems to regret really about relationship is then that narrows everything down to one person.
Yeah.
And he becomes like the focal point. Mm-hmm. So she's kind of saying, well, if I'm doing that, I need to find somebody who contains multitudes. Right? Mm-hmm. So that the kind of is sort of offset, if you like, in a way. So she's quite canny. And then she says, well, the only real person I can think of that would do that would be a poet.
Yeah.
Because they're very rich in their way of thinking about, you know. So it is actually, she's really thinking things through. But anyway, the point is really that there's many that I make in that essay, really. But one of the things I was kind of saying was that I loved the diaries. And I didn't really love the book as much as I wanted to. And I really felt something was lost when she novelized all those sorts of feelings. And it was almost like, you know, the language of the novella by Grand Central Station it's familiar to us. There's a lot of very familiar tropes in it. There's a lot of very ornate literary, you know, allusions to, I don't know. I just, this almost this sort of, almost like religious sort of, this about devotion and candles or something and cups overflowing and all that kind of, you know, all that kind of stuff. And it feels again, like we were saying earlier, there's something that exists already and she just sort of takes it and puts it on her set of experiences, and you think, well, why did you do that? You know, it was so much more interesting the way it was rendered before, when it was sort of moment by moment and in these sort of flashes of a feeling and then sort of analysis and then something completely unrelated and those lovely shifts. And I don't know, so it is and it's something I think about. And weirdly, I discovered that actually it was something that Beckett thought about a lot. I didn't realize really the extent to which a lot of his work is autobiographical.
Yeah,
never really appreciated that. And I didn't know that he was also himself very, very interested in the diary form. And he read, I mean, The Confessions by St. Augustine. And I think that's referenced like 100 times or more in Dreams of Fair to Middling Women. And who else? Jules Renard and Rousseau. He was very interested in self-writing, which... is actually, you can see that. So many of his characters are kind of self-inscribers and documenting themselves and archivists and so on. And again, it was that difficulty of, well, how do I turn this material into literature?
Yeah.
You know, and it is that thing, because I'm not interested in producing nonfiction. I don't really want to write personal essays. I don't really like that mode. I don't enjoy where that positions me at all. Mm-hmm. I much prefer working in a fictional kind of realm, because it's just, I can do more, I'm freer. Mm-hmm. And I'm not trying to establish any sort of particular truth. Yeah. And again, I'm not trying to be wise about anything. I'm not saying, well, you know, this is what I lived through, this is what happened to me, and this is the sense I made out of it. And you know what you mean?
Or
this
is the
lessons that I've been learned.
To learn,
you know,
lesson.
Because I haven't, and I know that. Yeah. I mean, I'm always embarking upon the same mistakes constantly. The time now it takes me to realise I'm doing the same stupid thing again is getting shorter and shorter. But it doesn't stop me from actually embarking upon the same doomed process. I can just pick it up much and I go, oh, you're doing this again.
Yes.
Why are you doing this again?
I really dislike any writing, I think, that forces a lesson upon you. I really feel like the essay form is terrible for that. Like I constantly do the same thing. Like I just make the same mistakes over and over. And I don't think I'm even noticing like half the time. But I much prefer writing that kind of acknowledges that. And something that I really felt when I read the diaries and then I read Simple Passion with Annie Ernaux was the dailiness was lost. So like the actual misery of like this unrequited love daily was lost.
Yeah, the tedium of it.
Yeah, and when it was put into the novel, and that was that was what really made me feel, you know? So something can, when it's moved, it can be a little lost.
Yeah, I suppose that's the thing, isn't it? So yeah, where do you place yourself? Because then, I mean, she still adheres to that very sort of like flatness of language.
She's very sort of
always kind of consciously sort of doing. So it's not necessarily that she's sort of poeticizing it so much, but when those things are sort of, I guess, removed and it becomes sort of more condensed, it can't help but become a little bit more, I guess, poetic in a way, you know?
Yeah.
Because some of the tedium and monotony and repetition is taken out of it. You know what I mean? And if that sort of, if that's still there, you know, then it's, Yeah, that's interesting, actually. That is interesting.
In Checkout 19, you write so beautifully about reading. And it's, you know, linked to life. And I really connected with those parts of the book. You know, there's long sections being like, I've read this, I haven't read this. Because I feel like sometimes, I feel like my reading life is more interesting than my writing life sometimes. How did you start thinking about that? Or obviously, like, reading has like shaped you in a way, and you wanted to write about it. So how did those sections kind of come about?
Well, that was sort of a bit by mistake.
One of those errors.
One of those funny things. Because I remember being upstairs. I remember we were talking yesterday about how, it's a pain doing housework and stuff like that. But it does sort of help, you know, you take a break and you go upstairs and you start kind of cleaning the bathroom or whatever. And actually, something that you've been sat at the desk sort of like getting in your knickers in a twist about, you know, suddenly you might just feel a shift and you go, oh, yeah, okay. So it was very much that. I remember being upstairs in the bathroom and I was cleaning the shower door. I hate cleaning the shower door. It's the crummiest job in the world, isn't it? It's just rotten. And mine actually kind of broke. It fell off and I haven't replaced it. I don't want another one. Yeah. I don't care if the water goes all over the floor. I just don't want to clean. It's lovely not having to clean. Every time I clean the bathroom now, I'm like, I don't have to clean the counter. Brilliant. And it takes so much. It's so much quicker. I'll keep the sink and the toilet, of course. I think I need those. But I was upstairs and I don't know what it was. It was just going to be one, I think one line where, and I don't know what the function of it was now, but it was, I had read The Sea of the Sea, for example, by Iris Murdoch, but I hadn't read such and such. I had read such and such and such, but I hadn't read that. And I just liked the rhythm of that. Mm. And I liked that thing again. I love opposites, you know, I love establishing something and then sort of taking away or something. So there's a kind of, well, there was this, but then there wasn't that. Well, there was this, but there wasn't that, you know? So it's like, oh, okay. So there was something gained, but there was something still yet to be gained, or there was something still missing, or you know what I mean? I just love playing with that, really. And I like the rhythm of this. So I went back downstairs. And of course, you know, you could probably tell by now that once I start on something, I can just kind of keep going. So there was a bit of that was happening. And I just kept going because I just kept thinking of more and more and more. And then how interesting it is that at certain times of your life, you know, there are certain books that are sort of maybe influencing just how you're being in that moment and how you're seeing certain things. And then there are certain books that aren't there yet.
Yeah.
You know, and looking back, you kind of think, oh, you know, like the Anne Quinn, when I was in Brighton, at that stage, I had no knowledge of her, you know, but years later, recalling me being in Brighton, bit, you know, cheesed off and having a fag down by that pebbly beach. And then subsequently discovering her and discovering that she lived in Brighton and her mother lived in Brighton and she died in Brighton in the sea. And then weirdly being able to sort of conflate those two things, even though at the time I knew nothing about her. Yeah. You know, it's sort of a strange layering. Yeah. Again, I'm interested in that. And like I said, I'm reading Madame Bovary now. Yeah. And that's weird because I've never read Madame Bovary.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know whether it's just as well I didn't read Madame Bovary before now because I think it would have really, really just... Because I can identify it with so much. Mm. And it really is how I was when I was younger. An absolute fantasist. Mm-hmm. Just But again, you know, we kind of reduce that and think it's kind of, you know, a bit silly and a bit, you know, she's got a head full of whatever. And people would say that, we've got a head full of nonsense and a head full of, you know, fancy ideas and all that kind of thing. And that's the way it's sort of diminished, I think, in a young woman.
Yeah.
But really, again, it's to do with that hunger.
Mm.
And it bizarrely, weirdly relates, I think, to Lucy's story.
Mm.
Because that's about, I mean, you could read that literally and say, oh, maybe she's had, I don't know, a miscarriage or something like that. But I don't tend to look at it particularly that way. And she says there's been an ache for as long as she can remember. Mm. And there's this description in Madame Bovary, and she, or Flaubert, I mean, it's amazing how he can write this, but he writes, you know, she's kind of, you know, fed up. She's newly married. They live in this sort of French, I guess, small kind of town. And he's a doctor, right? Charles, he's a kind of a local, but not especially sort of distinguished. So anyway, she's kind of bored. And he refers to this indiscernible disquiet. How to express an indiscernible disquiet, which alters its shape like the clouds, which whirls like the wind. So she could not find the words, the opportunity, the boldness. And so it's just there.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's just there. And I just, you know, I remember, I get that even now sometimes,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
It's just, you don't know what it is. It's got nothing to do with, you know, everything seems to be kind of, you know, good actually. And then suddenly it can be this sort of, just this sense of indiscernible disquiet.
Mm. I think that that's something that we were saying there about Lucy's story as well, that in short stories or in novels, I feel like you're often, you know, expected to give a reason. You know, there has to be a reason for why she would feel this way.
Yeah.
That it has, and then this would logically lead to X and stuff. But in life, there often isn't a reason. You just feel that way. Like a feeling like that can just come over you. And there is no explanation and things. And I think that's really why I admire your work a lot. I feel like you capture those kind of moments and feelings that just arise and you can't do anything about them.
Yeah. I think, it's, I mean, there's always that tendency, of course, we always think that by finding an explanation, we've somehow made something more bearable.
Yeah.
But then sometimes I just don't know how real those explanations are in a way.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? You just kind of think, just sort of making something up here, aren't I?
Yeah, yeah.
Just sort of, what it probably has nothing to do with that at all, actually.
Yeah.
And what I'm finding, I suppose, kind of exciting to think about as I'm working on material at the moment is just like not explaining and not actually contextualizing stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I find that really exciting in writing. Like, again, Beckett takes that to an extreme, right? Mm. As we've already sort of discussed, he strips away all the things that give context to, you know, time, place, what, where, when. You know, it's like they don't know themselves.
Yeah.
And he shows that the characters don't really know themselves. You know, they don't quite know who they are. They don't quite know when this is. They don't know where they are particularly. And so on. That's very extreme. But something can still be taken from that and applied in a maybe less extreme kind of way. And there is something very appealing about, I mean, because I've just never really naturally got, you know, been inclined that way as a writer anyway, to provide, you know, like a setup and a background and, you know, all that kind of thing. I just don't go in for it. So
I agree. I think, I feel like I encounter a lot of characters now with a lot of self-knowledge, you know, they know they're doing this because they're this kind of person and this happened to them and things. And don't believe. I don't believe in self-knowledge. Claire Louise, you are an absolute delight. What a treat for Valentine's Day. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Nicole. It was a pleasure.
If you've enjoyed this episode, please share it. Or if you're new to the podcast, please subscribe. We'll be back next month with another writer reading a story from the Stinging Fly archive. Access to the Stinging Fly's full archive is available to everyone who subscribes to the magazine and to our patrons. Taking out a subscription is a great way to support what we do. I want to thank the Arts Council, who provide funding for this podcast, and for everything else that the Stinging Fly is doing to seek out, nurture, publish, and promote the very best new writers in writing. Thank you for listening.